I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This week on Change Surfer, we'll be doing the first half of an interview with Dan DiNello, who's the author of Technophobia. He's a filmmaker, culture critic, a Chicago-based artsy-type person, and he's written a very interesting book about how science fiction film in particular is a response to transhumanist aspirations and the techno-military, corporatist, fascist intent to transform us into post-human beings. You can imagine that we have a very interesting conversation about those topics. So this is the first half of that interview, and next week you can listen to the second half, or you could download it anytime you want at IEET.org. I'm speaking today with Dan DiNello. Dan is an independent filmmaker, teacher, and author. His most recent book is Technophobia, Science Fiction Visions of Post-Human Technology, which is just great. He also writes for the Chicago Tribune. He lives in Chicago, teaches film and video production and critical studies at Columbia College Chicago. He also has some interesting friends. His nephew, Paul DiNello, was part of the set with Stephen Colbert and Amy Sedaris that produced Strangers with Candy, and they have made some films together with Dan called Beyond the Door, Shock Asylum, and Wheels of Fury. And all this stuff can be found out at Dan's very interesting website, which is shockproductions.com. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks.
So I have to say, I first saw your book advertised someplace, it was probably on Amazon, Amazon link that said, you need to buy this book. And I was delighted with the topic because I have been interested in attitudes towards science and technology, in particular biotechnology, mm-hmm. in science fiction, literature, and film for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. I taught a course in the Open University of the Left there in Chicago back in 1990 on science fiction and biopolitics, and then started to do some research on this. But I have a very different take on it. And one of the reasons is that I eventually became the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association and now of a transhumanist think tank called the IET. So you can imagine that my reading of these materials and their role in society might be a little different. So let's lay out the basic argument that you're making is that that there are people like transhumanists and other techno-utopians in the corporate, military-industrial complex and all those folks who are trying to sell us a vision of the future that where there will be whiz-bang everything.
Right.
And that science fiction, in particular...
Well, I wouldn't say just whiz-bang everything, really. Technology that's going to either transform us into another species or somehow produce a alternative species where we may become extinct as a result or fuse with it way in the future.
Mm-hmm. Cyborgs and things like that.
Right.
Right. And there certainly are enthusiasts for that. People like Ray Kurzweil, who do have some supporters and enthusiasts in the scientific and industrial world.
Well, he definitely was an early inspiration for the book.
Right. And then, so your reading of what science fiction is doing is that much of science fiction is showing popular anxieties about that kind of a future, showing anxieties about robotics and genetic engineering and those kinds of issues. And I think that that's, clear enough so far. But let me start off by asking this kind of a question. What does Frankenstein, the book Frankenstein, which is used as a shorthand for a lot of these critiques, mm-hmm. does it really teach us anything about how to regulate cadaveric organ transplantation? I mean, we have this technology today which horrified our ancestors and which probably has been the MacGuffin in a number of different science fiction stories from the early part of this century about how we're going to take organs from dead people and put them in living people. We mm-hmm. do it all the time now. We accept that it's legitimate and it's no longer a subject for a legitimate horror story. Mm-hmm. And, so I don't know what reading some of these anxieties into these original science fiction stories really tells us about what to do about technology today.
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure that's the role of art is necessarily to show us what to do. I think the role is to play out, in the case of science fiction, play out certain technologies. And I'm interested in talking about ones that are sort of on the horizon or currently available, not sort of fantasy technology. But at any rate, I don't necessarily think that science fiction, you know, the role of art isn't to create public policy, but it is to look at things such that there is debate that might lead to a certain kind of policy. So I think it raises issues and concerns and suggests potential areas of debate. Now, also more specifically to your question, too, Frankenstein, yes, the specific technology it deals with could be considered literally using dead body parts to create an artificial human. But really, I look at science fiction in more metaphorically speaking. So Frankenstein, it's about one literal kind of technology, but really it's a metaphor for technology, just as, Battlestar Galactica's vision of the Cylons as this robotic species. Yes, it may talk about literally some robotic species of the future, but right for us now, and science fiction does this in an interesting way, it talks about our present condition and our present kind of technology. So I'm looking at it more metaphorically than literally. Although in some cases, let's say Gattaca, there is a kind of literalness to it. It's dealing with a technology that's, imminent, and that it's, so close to being current that, some of that may be taken more literally.
Well, okay, but the MacGuffin of Gattaca was that a guy with a terminal chronic heart condition should be able to become an astronaut. And I don't think anybody in NASA today would agree that you shouldn't have to go through medical testing, genetic or otherwise, to determine whether you're going to die on a mission in space. And he went up, was one of six people in a capsule, and he's supposed to be, the shining heroic example of fight back against our genetic future. I don't understand how that informs, our critique of biotechnology today.
Well, again, I don't want to use this, I don't want to harp on this, and maybe you want to go in a different direction, but, if you want to look at, you can look at Gattaca again in that literal way that he has a heart condition and that, you are also looking at it as a kind of allegory of the power of the human spirit, let's say. Somehow he's overcome his defects. Now you might say, well, there's no way to, the heart defect, that's a biological limitation. There's nothing you can do about it. But
if it had been about an astronaut today who hid the fact that they were HIV positive,
mm-hmm.
Until they got into space, until they were up on the space station, I don't think anybody would have seen that as a heroic act. Okay, I don't want to harp on it, but you're
right.
I guess what another part. And let me throw a couple different slices at the way that your analytical frame on this.
Sure.
And there may be aspects of your book that I've missed. But one is that I think there's a big difference in the attitudes towards technology and these biopolitical questions in science fiction literature versus science fiction film, because so much of science fiction film was of the giant bug that ate, Cleveland variety. Which has this?
I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay.
Because I want you to carry on with this question, but this whole, this snide characterization, let's say, of 50s science fiction, say the giant mutated ants as being some stupid, silly, dumb, the bug-eyed monster. I don't look at it that way because those bug-eyed monsters symbolize the, radiation mutation, and radiation mutation was a specific fear in the 50s. I had it myself. I'm older than you. I grew up then, and so, I went to these movies, and yes, they were entertaining and sort of surreally stupid in a way at one level, but at another level, they scared the crap out of me, and part of it had to do with my fear of nuclear technology. So, go ahead, though, but I think that's a kind of, a pejorative putting these into a category that makes them sound like, they have no other value.
Well, I'll grant that. I mean, okay. I think you can even grant, you know, that Godzilla was about Japanese anxiety about that kind of stuff as well, and you know, that all those themes were there. But if you for instance, go back to the film adaptation of H.G. Wells's Things to Come, which was, you know, one of his most utopian, we go through nuclear annihilation and then we build this utopian world.
Yes.
And in the film adaptation and in the novel, Luddites come and try to destroy the spaceship, and the spaceship blasts off. And it's clear, you know, that the narrative is we need to keep moving on and progressing, and technological progress needs to continue.
Sure.
And then you get into this post-World War II film narrative, and the MacGuffin is often these new technologies, nuclear technology or biotechnology or whatever, that are themselves the problem, rather than ignorance or greed or inequality. It's these technologies that are the problem. Now, I think you
right. I mean, I'm going to stop you there. That for one thing, you're characterizing the use of technology as being MacGuffins, which, from my understanding of, you know, sort of Hitchcock analysis, the MacGuffin was a kind of a meaningless element tossed in simply for, you know, plot purposes of suspense or, you know, but it really had no thematic resonance. But, you know, I don't agree. Technology is the central aspect of science fiction. That's what it's about. That's what the genre is about. So I think the use of the term MacGuffin is another way that you're sort of demeaning science fiction. But on the other hand, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, I think you're heading towards this notion where science fiction cinema is somehow more in the order of the technophobic vision that I talk about in my book, and that you can find certainly a lot more, you know, if you look at science fiction literature, you can find, you know, counterexamples, and but I'm not quite sure what point you want to make about that.
Well, I guess one point is that I contrast the role of speculative fiction in getting people to think about these issues.
Yeah.
Between, for instance, horror and fantasy fiction and science fiction. And in that contrast, certainly in the literature, but even to some extent in the film, you find, you know, much more complex, in my opinion, attitudes and visions of the future in science fiction films. So, for instance, in Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Generation, you have this very positive depiction of a robot who's a serving military officer. He defends his
Data.
Own Data.
Okay.
You know, he defends his own personhood when people try to take him apart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a horror context, that he would have been evil just, you know, by the nature of his being not being human.
Well, I would argue though that you're right, and there certainly is a subgenre of even science. I mean, you're referring to science fiction television, which we would think would be even more simplistic than science fiction cinema, but you're talking about this particular entity, Data, as a kind of representative of a positive view of a cyborg or a robot. But I agree with you. There is certainly a subgenre, and I consider Data to be sort of in the lineage of R2-D2 and Robbie from Forbidden Planet. They're sort of slave-like entities, in fact. Even though, you know, Data is certainly a sharp guy, and he often, you know, leads the party. But in effect, he served as a kind of slave to humanity. And in fact, I think in the most recent Star Trek movie, he even commits suicide in order to save the human beings on the ship. So this subgenre, it's interesting. It's kind of pro-technology in a way, but Star Trek, you know, Next Generation also had the Borg, and the Borg were, you know, pure evil, and the sort of this dominating cyborg species, and, you know, they differed because they had a hive mind, and that's always viewed as a really horrible, horrible thing, and Data was a more typically, you know, an individual, sort of a liberal Democrat type.
Well,
but I agree with you. Certainly, there's these pro technology threads. But
well, let's dilate on that point for a second,
sure.
Because a lot of science fiction critics who come at it from a progressive political point of view, as you and I both do, have pointed out that the theme of anti-collectivism, you know, both in the Cold War and then after the Cold War as well, is certainly there in science fiction, and that a lot of science fiction reflected a kind of libertarian male lonerism.
Right.
You know, so that it's so all of these things that, you know, are reflected in science fiction about the Borg being evil. You know, there are people who identify with the Borg. You know, you go to these Star Trek conventions, there are people who dress up like Borg and have Borg parties and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have like a little figure of the Borg. I love the Borg.
So I just see a lot more complexity in it. You know, so I'll give you another example. Dark Angel, which was this about genetically engineered super soldiers who had animal genes. It was Cameron's project.
Oh, that was the TV show with that that woman as the star?
Right, I forget her name. But
yeah,
she's
in Sin City, I think.
Yes, exactly. She's an incredibly beautiful woman, but
I'm
spacing on her name.
Dark Angel, all right.
It starts out as, you know, America's a military dictatorship. The evil military has made these gene-engineered soldiers. They break out. But at the very last, you know, as it evolves, you begin to identify with these gene-engineered soldiers, and you begin to despise the racism of the normals towards these gene-engineered people, and you want to see them as they are trying to create at the very end of the series. You want them to be able to live in society as equals among everybody else. So the narrative is very complicated. It's say, yes, people shouldn't be gene tweaked against their will, and they shouldn't be used for others' military purposes. But at the same time, we should be a tolerant enough society so that gene tweaked animal people should be able to live among us.
Oh, right, definitely. I can't argue with you about not really familiar other than generally with that show, but it sounds like you're making a sort of point that that more technophobic science fiction is simple minded or simple and other science fiction that has this kind of a positive technological element is more complex. And again, in those examples, maybe that's true. But taking Battlestar. Do you watch Battlestar Galactica?
Religiously, yes.
Yeah. So I mean, you can look at that. I feel like that's pretty complex. But look at the kind of anti-technology element there. I mean, it's like the good guys refuse to use network computers. They deliver. I mean, sometimes you can't understand the dialogue because the technology of their audio stuff is so bad. You know what I'm saying? They like deliberately limit their technology because they've created this this alternative species. And I guess what I love too, and we haven't gotten into this, but most people that look at Battlestar Galactica consider it a kind of, at least back when they were on that planet and they were sort of under the oppression of the Cylons, as a kind of allegory of the Iraq War. And, I take that as a really important element of that science fiction and other science fiction. There's sort of political notion that technology is often tied in with the authoritarian kind of fascistic culture. And, to me, part of the Iraq War was a result of technological hubris and, you know, the idea that technology solves all of our problems. And, like in Chicago here, Mayor Daley is like, more surveillance cameras is going to stop crime. So it looks at technology as the panacea and doesn't look at other sort of social reforms that might, you know, more significantly and more permanently alter the status quo. So I think too, I got a little out of the way, but my point is that Battlestar Galactica is extremely complex in its themes and the kinds of things it deals with. But in my opinion, it kind of suggests a real technophobic perspective, and one that even goes further than maybe I would even agree with, you know, like this Bill McKibben's Enough, where he says that we have enough technology, it should stop at this point. That seems like the point of view of that series. I don't agree with that, but
It's very interesting that you would read it that way. I certainly see the first season that way, but I think that the series has become, again, more complex in its depiction. I mean, there is a long narrative in science fiction about whether robots could have rights.
Robots could what?
Could have rights.
Okay.
And whether you know, whether human racial purity, separate from any kind of machine intervention in our bodies, is something that we should be worried about. You know, this, whether cyborgization is itself some kind of threat to human values.
Right.
And so you have here in Battlestar Galactica, like you've had in many films and books, you have these combinations of human and machine. And at first, they're treated simply as the enemy. Of course, they do a horrific genocidal act. But then you get them into a situation where they're POWs or where they're your loved one. And it begins to pose that question. What exactly is wrong? You know, under what conditions could a human machine hybrid or a human machine cyborg be a legitimate member of our society, be someone who you loved, be someone who was rights bearing?
So, and I think that's really interesting, and I agree with that, especially, you know, on Battlestar Galactica, because there is a kind of shifting ground as far as what do the Cylons represent, because in certain aspects the Cylons in some ways represent a fanatic technological culture a la the United States, but you're right in another extent, and robots are often used. I mean, in Blade Runner, robots are used to ask that same question. So in Battlestar Galactica, you have the Cylon, you know, in that camp, and at that point, they're evoking the Abu Ghraib or torture in general, and whether we have a right what kind of human beings are going to do this even to a machine. So, yes, I agree. Robots, cyborgs, artificial humans, even Frankenstein is characterized as sort of, the object of social prejudice and kind of not, he's obviously he's considered a monster. He is a monster. But you know what I'm saying? He's still like a social outcast, so to speak. And so there is this thread through science fiction where human imitating machines and artificial humans come to help us understand, you know, racism and sexism and play a part in that as well.
Right. I absolutely agree that often it's a metaphor. Like in Men in Black, the very, very first scene is that they stop a group of Mexican immigrants who are sneaking across the border in the back of a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that one of the Mexican immigrants is actually an illegal immigrant from space. And, they let the Mexican immigrants in, but they stop this alien. But at any rate, I think that, yes, I mean, you can definitely see that theme, and some of the writers who I greatly admire, you know, Isaac Asimov and other people in the 50s and 60s who explored issues around alien, you know, tolerance and robot tolerance and things like that. It was a metaphor for civil rights and gay rights and other kinds of issues.
Are you familiar? There's a movie you should see from the 60s called Creation of the Humanoids.
No.
From 1963, its only claim to fame was that it's Andy Warhol's favorite movie, supposedly. But it's an amazing, it's kind of boring. It's almost like an experimental movie. I mean, it's so flat, and it's a low budget, but you can still find it. It's both funny, and it's incredibly, and it's got this notion of humans prejudice against robots, but it's really interesting. It's almost a precursor of Blade Runner.
By the way, I'm speaking with Dan Danilo. He's the author of Technophobia, Science Fiction Visions of Post-Human Technology, which is just a fascinating study of the images around artificial intelligence, robotics, bionics, the internet, biotechnology, nano, and machine plague, which we have to get to. Ways that they are counterpoint and critique to techno-utopianism. Let's go back to some of the science fiction, if you consider it that. Something like Looking Backward, the novel. Who was the author of that? He was a utopian socialist at the turn of the century, wrote this novel, Looking Backward. And basically, he was projecting what Boston would be like in the year 2000. And this novel apparently had a huge...
Edward Bellamy,
right. This novel apparently had a huge impact, and there were clubs started all over the United States to promote the vision of Looking Backward. which included a cashless society and that you'd be able to listen to opera through special tubes that would run into your house and things like that. It was also a militarized society because everyone had to work. They were given jobs according to military prescription, and everyone had to work in those jobs. So it was kind of a communistic fascistic vision as well.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, you don't see any of those kinds of utopian narratives. You know, they're, to the degree that you see utopianism, it's much more clouded and muddied in most of the literature or film that comes out today. And I think part of the reason is that that kind of narrative really doesn't work for at least modern readers. Maybe for oppressed industrial workers 100 years ago it worked, but today a modern reader doesn't really get excited about simply a description of a very nice place to live.
Right. I mean, it has something to do with the nature of drama and the notion of, there necessarily being some conflictual elements that produce the drama. And, I guess that's to some extent correct. But I think two notions of utopianism, the 60s produced its version of utopianism, which was, what was that guy's name? Like William Morris, who was a...
Right.
More of, huh?
Well, yeah, William Morris is more of a pastoral utopian.
Yeah, more of a pastoral sort of look, almost a Luddite version that we can only find perfection in nature and, sort of an anti-machine vision. And I think the 60s and the hippies, to some extent, were reproducing that. That might be the last sort of utopian sort of subculture or vision of some sort of future utopia. But I think a lot of the sort of the techno-utopian stuff stopped, I think, more with the rise of the world wars, the notion, where people saw that how technology and how machines were used in such an incredibly destructive manner and a kind of just a sort of slaughter of humanity. And so I believe that the world wars and the sort of techno slaughter that was the result really put the really closed the door on a kind of straight on vision of techno utopianism. But I certainly believe that it sort of revived in the 90s with Kurzweil and Moravec and maybe some of the biotechnophiles. I don't know if you admire like Gregory Stork or Stock and Lee Silver and those people seem to have and they don't put it in the. I mean, that's part of my point. They're like scientists who get off on this techno utopian vision, and that's what I'm doing in my book is contrasting the sort of science fiction vision of those same technologies.
That was the first part of our interview with Dan Nonello, who's the author of Technophobia, a study of attitudes towards technology in science fiction film primarily. And you can read more about Dan at his website, which is shockproductions.com. And you can listen to this or the second half of the interview at IEET.org. Otherwise, stay tuned for the second half of this interview with Dan Nonello next week on Change Surfer Radio. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.